Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So when the body is neglected and allowed to atrophy, the results are pretty noticeable. Subway seats get tight and you tend to sweat on cold days. But when the brain is allowed to get out of shape, people just make excuses. They say things like, well, if that's how you think, then fine. Or maybe they take advantage of you. They say things like, you know what? I think this timeshare is a great idea for you. The mind isn't a muscle, not literally, but if we're in tune to our brain, if we know how it works, and if we work it out a little bit, we'll all be a little bit sharper. So says Dr. John Medina. He's the director of the Brain Center for Applied Learning Research at Seattle Pacific University. He's a professor of bioengineering at the University of Washington. And more to the point, he has written Brain Rules, 12 Principles for Surviving and Thriving at Homework and School. Dr. John Medina, welcome to WNYC.
Pleasure to talk to you, Mike.
I know one of the rules is don't be boring, so we can't just list 12 rules right off the bat and expect people to pay attention to us. But before I even ask you about the rules, is that some way appealing to the brain to say there are 12 bullet point items? Does that hook the brain more to put a number on it, or is that just what publishers think you should do?
Well, I think it's more of a publishing fad, but in fact, your brain wants to process information in chunks. It wants to process it in batch files. So creating numbers and bullet points behind something is a convenient way to summarize very complex information simply.
And so if we were to take, and the 12 steps are, you know, real simple things that I think that in other aspects of life you're always told to do anyway, like exercise and sleep and watch out for stress, and you talk a lot about vision. But, you know, is there a fundamental, if you had to pick out one of these steps, is there the fundamental step in understanding how the brain works and how it could work better for you?
Well, there's an overarching performance envelope that I think addresses all 12 almost simultaneously, and maybe I can talk a little bit about that. We actually don't know very much about how the brain works, Mike, to be honest. I mean, we don't even know how you know how to pick up a glass of water and drink it, let alone do something that says, well, maybe if you do this, you're going to be a better educated person. If you do this, you're going to be a better business person. So we have to start from the basics, and those are the evolutionary basics, because we're not clueless. We do know something about the brain's performance envelope. Here it is. The brain appears to have been designed to solve problems related to surviving in an outdoor setting in unstable meteorological conditions, and to do so in near constant motion. All 12 rules in the book Brain Rules can be discovered in that one sentence about the performance envelope. In fact, I began the book as a thought experiment because there's a lot of mythologies out there about how the brain actually works. You may have heard that we only use 10% of our brain, that there's a left brain and a right brain personality, a whole range of, I'll just call them mythologies, like a Mozart effect.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. So you have to begin it as a thought experiment. I wondered, if you re-engineered education and business learning environments to take advantage of the little we do know about how the brain works, what would that look like? What would a classroom look like? What would a business look like? And so from that performance envelope, whereby you are looking at surviving, and the brain is the world's chief survival organ, the little that we do know suggested to me, it hit me, if you wanted to create a learning environment that was directly opposed to what the brain was naturally good at doing, you would probably design something like a traditional American classroom. And if you wanted to design a business environment that was directly opposed to what the brain was naturally good at doing, you would probably design something like a cubicle, Mike. And if you were really interested in re-engineering learning environments to take advantage of whatever more modern understanding we actually have about how the organ works, you're going to have to tear down both and start over.
Well, this is why I'm starting a college where all the classes will be outdoors in the rain while running around. I understand your point, but that doesn't seem practical. What can we do practically?
Well, I'm an ivory tower type. I'm not into practical, but I think there is a natural, business professionals, education scientists, and brain scientists don't get together very often.
Right.
So the best thing you can do from offering practical advice are practical research questions that both of those sides could do together, and then you could probably become prescriptive. Let me give an example. It's been estimated that we were walking in our native cave person days anywhere between 10 to 15 kilometers a day for millions of years, this wonderful organ of ours, this problem-solving, most complex organ in the known universe, was built under conditions of near-constant aerobic exposure. You might predict from that a hypothesis. You might say, okay, if that's the case, then the performance of the brain might be optimized under conditions where you were moving as opposed to you were not. Mm-hmm. So here's the experiment. Some folks took a bunch of fat, sedentary Japanese fourth graders who would IV a Big Mac if they could, and who would certainly work their Xboxes all day long, and gave them a pretest for their cognitive performance measures on something that we call executive function. Executive function is involved in planning and foresight. It helps you do math better because it allows you to take a hierarchy of disparate data and put them into some organized algorithm, and gave them their baseline score, and then exercise the heck out of them for 3 months. Aerobic exercise, not strengthening, but just pure aerobic exercise, and then measured their executive function scores again. And what was revealed was astonishing, Mike. They got anywhere between an 80 to 100% uptick in the cognitive performance simply by exposing aerobic exercise for about, I think the experiment was somewhere between 9 and 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. Then they did the most important experiment. They extracted the exercise. They told those fat, sedentary Japanese fourth graders that they could go back to their old nasty habits, eat what they wanted, and go back to the Xbox. When they did that, within a month, their executive function scores had plummeted to pre-intervention levels. So that suggests something very strongly to us. In fact, if you were to tear it all down and start it over and reimagine, it's very possible that the classroom of the future would not be populated with desks. It would be populated with treadmills. And we would be learning while we were in motion, and that the school of the future would simply be this giant 8-hour workout that was punctuated with very specific hours of learning followed by more exercise. In the current system, we actually have that inverted.
Great. The school of the future is an OK Go video. Great to know. Our number is 212-433-9692. The question is, do you have any brain rules? Do you have any brain tips on staying productive and efficient? Dr. Medina there just talked about exercise, and I am Mike Pesky in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Look, do they know why the exercise works? Can they pinpoint, these neurons are firing or this chemical is released and that helps the brain's performance?
Oh, they sure can. In fact, it's a very mature story. There is molecular, cellular, and behavioral components to the whole story. Let's start with the cellular. You can actually show that if you are doing aerobic exercise, you increase the cerebral blood volume. We call it CBV. Just think of it as the amount of blood. You increase the volume to a very specific area of the brain called the hippocampus. You've heard of the hippocampus before, I assume?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the
one of my favorites. It's no medulla oblongata, but I like it.
This is New York, isn't it?
Yeah.
The specific area of the hippocampus is called the dentate gyrus. It's involved in the conversion of short-term to long-term memory. Increasing blood flow is a very important thing to do. You actually add more nutrients to the system, and you've got a better garbage collection system if you can increase the blood flow. So at the cellular level, that's a good thing. We know that it's a specific effect, by the way. It doesn't affect other parts of the brain. It's not a rising tide fits all. It works specifically on areas of the brain that are involved in learning.
And
we also
go ahead. No, you go ahead.
We also know about this story at the molecular level. We know there's a magic ingredient in the brain called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. You can think of it as Miracle-Gro for the brain. If you've got BDNF floating around in certain neurons, those neurons are happy. They grow better. They form better connections. You can actually get more connections. They function in a more powerful way involved in learning. Exercise has been shown to increase the amount of BDNF per unit cell in specific areas of the brain involved in learning. So not only do we know about blood volume, we also know about molecules.
So I think you've convinced me to do the rest of this interview standing up, because I think that'll help my questions a little bit. In fact, that's how Donald Rumsfeld conducted his day. He had one of those desks that were built so that he could conduct business while standing the whole time. Sometimes I feel like I need that.
Well, this interview probably would be more productive if you and I were both on treadmills and we were sitting there talking to each other while BDNF was coursing into areas of our brain. You'd ask a better question and I perhaps would give a better answer.
Right, because what people like to hear on the radio is this. So, doctor. So, in the book, You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald once said something like, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the sign of a first-rate brain is the ability to hold opposing ideas together at the same time. And I think your book has a few opposing ideas. You talk often about here is the brain, the human brain. These are pretty much the rules for all the brains. But then one chapter is every brain is wired differently. So could you sort that out for us a little bit?
Oh, I sure can. Yeah, every brain is wired differently than every other brain and learns in ways unique to that wiring. That's the full rule. Every brain is wired differently, that's for sure. But how is it that we could possibly do brain surgery if every brain is wired differently? How could we possibly teach brain anatomy if every brain is wired differently? Well, it turns out that you have, if you think of neurons the same way you think of the American highway system, you've got interstates, you've got state roads, you've got city roads and boulevards, and then you've got dirt roads. All of our interstates are pretty much the same from one person to the next. Mike, your interstate's in something we call the dopaminergic pathway. Mm-hmm. Dopamine, which you may have heard of before. Serotonin, the serotonergic pathway. Those pathways are pretty similar from one person to the next. Those are our interstates. When you drop down to a more complex level, now you get to the state roads, still the state roads are pretty similar from one person to the next. Your motor cortex is wired and communicates with your spinal cord the same way mine does. So you have these more minor roads. But when you get down to the boulevards, and when you get down to the dirt roads and the pathways of our brain, that's where you begin to see the balkanization. That's where you begin to see the individual differences. And there, no two brains are wired the same. There's a dramatic way to show this. Have you heard of electrical stimulation mapping before? Do you know what that is?
I'm not sure. Go ahead. Tell me.
ESM. You may know that there are no pain neurons in the brain.
Yeah.
And so brain surgery is often done when the patient is conscious, when the patient is awake. And you can literally talk to the patient while their cranial vault is open and their brain tissue is exposed to the air. And so the question was asked was, if there's not any pain neurons and you can communicate, if you take a little electric, it looks like a pen, it's called a stimulator, mm-hmm. and stimulate an area of open brain tissue, you can touch an area of the brain and ask the patient, what did you just feel? How did you just respond? And so on. So you can actually create a map. And that's going to be important to do if you're a brain surgeon. You have to do it nearly every time you do brain surgery. Because if you want to, let's say you need to cut out a piece of tissue because there's a tumor in it, you have to map all the areas around that tumor to find out if there's any critical areas, if there's any of those dirt roads or boulevards that are going to be so critical that it could interfere with life function. The reason why a brain surgeon has to map it every time he goes in is that everybody's dirt roads are different than everybody else's, and the brain surgeon doesn't know where the critical areas are going to be, and he's going to have to interrogate the patient.
This is Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking with Dr. John Medina, author of The Brain Rules. And in a minute, we will figure out how Jennifer Aniston factors into all of this. I promise you, stick around. Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC, speaking with John Medina, Dr. John Medina, author of Brain Rules, 12 Principles for Surviving and Thriving at Home, Work, or Work Home and School. One comment that came in over Facebook, Anne Marie says she's a teacher. She's trained her mind to do lesson planning while she swims boring laps. Over the years, it has become a habit of mind. I wonder if she retires and she'll be thinking about, all right, third period Spanish, fourth period math. And a few calls have come in to 212-433-9692. Among them, Eric from Little Neck. Hello, Eric.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good. Your comment.
I just wanted to add some information. Pediatrician derives from Latin for foot because Socrates conducted his classes while strolling about with his young students. And so youth became associated with foot, and that reinforces what your guest said about the brain being designed for movement.
Learning on the go, yeah.
Right.
Thanks for
that. Yeah, and he also strolled around and asked them tons of questions so that there was a constant sense of exploration while they were moving, which is just about what we were doing in the Serengeti for several million years.
And one of the other things, I think Socrates did it. I know in ancient times, a father would show his son the extent of his land and slap him because that sudden shock made him say, this is so important, you're going to have to learn. And I think Socrates would use a little shock method too. And you write about something like that. An important, for you to remember something important, it helps to pair it with kind of an attention-getting device.
Well, absolutely. The brain rule is this. People don't pay attention to boring things. It's just the case. What do they pay attention to is what that chapter is all about, and it's this. The human brain processes meaning before it processes detail, and we should probably talk a little bit about meaning because that's an unpackable and actually a series of falsifiable questions. Whenever a piece of information or any stimuli is coming into the brain, you can think of it, the brain cycling through six questions that it immediately interrogates the stimulus with. Here they are. Can I eat it? Will it eat me? We pay tons of attention to energy resource, and we pay tons of attention to threats to our ability to eat that energy resource. The third and fourth questions are, can I mate with it? Will it mate with me? We pay tons of attention to reproductive opportunity. We pay tons of attention to the whole reason why we wanted to survive in the first place, which was to pass our genes, project our genes to the next generation. The fifth and sixth questions have no a priori, but I think they're the most interesting. It's this: have I seen it before? Have I never seen it before? If you think you've seen it before, you're much more likely to pay attention. That's why product placement works in movies. You can show that if somebody has seen it before, they go to the grocery store, they map off of it, boom, all of a sudden they're paying more attention to it, more likely to grab the product off the shelf.
Yeah, it's why all advertising works, even bad advertising. Like, oh yeah, Chrysler, I've heard of that car. What have you heard of it? I don't know, heard of it.
Yeah. Well, after 8 o'clock at night, I see sex and death in all of the commercials for broadcast television on a regular basis. I see all six of those questions in full operation. So Madison Avenue and marketing executives have known about this for years. They may not have known that there's a strong, solid brain science behind it, but it's definitely there.
Sex and death as the hook, which I think brings me to, well, not the death part, but there's this Jennifer Aniston neuron. And I find there's something interesting about what was thought of the Jennifer Aniston neuron. Okay, I think I'm getting this right. Scientists have identified, it used to be the idea that a specific piece of information was attached to a specific neuron. And
right.
I think the researcher called it the grandmother effect, because if
right.
you mention someone's
right.
grandmother, he
yeah.
said, oh, that neuron will help you think of the grandmother.
Yeah.
And for 30 years or so, people mocked the grandmother effect. Then all of a sudden, it got called the Jennifer Aniston effect, and now everyone believes it? Why? Because she's sexier? Explain this to me.
Yeah, well, there's can I mate with it? Will it mate with me?
Yeah.
Mike got it in spades. And also, since this is going to be brain surgery, we've got death all wrapped up in one incredible paper that I think was published in a leading scientific journal, Nature. The grandmother hypothesis is what it's called, and the idea is that there is this abstract neuron in your brain that controls virtually everything you know about a very particular subject, in this case, a particular person. And that was shown, confirmed in dramatic fashion with Jennifer Aniston. Here's the experiments that were done. 64 tiny electrodes were implanted into somebody's hippocampus before they went in for resections for epilepsy, which means they're going to take out a piece of the brain because the person is epileptic, and they were given permission to put 64 tiny electrodes into the hippocampus before they did the surgery. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Now, remember, the patient is awake because you are consciously aware during surgery. So each of these participants who allowed this experiment to proceed were shown large numbers of images of celebrities and animals and objects and buildings, and the electrodes recorded the individual brain cells firing. Great, you can see it. That is a screening stage because it determined which image would elicit a strong response in at least one neuron, because people are drilling down trying to get at the grandmother hypothesis. The surgical team then tested those responses to, I don't know, 4, 9, 12 variations of those images from a narrowed list, and here's what they found. In one patient, a single neuron, now we've got an electrode in it, responded to 7 different photographs of Jennifer Aniston, while it ignored 80 other images of animals, buildings, famous or non-famous people that were presented. Even President Clinton was used as a control. In fact, I have a quote in the book. Kian Kreger did the work. He says, "The first time we saw a neuron firing to 7 different pictures of Jennifer Aniston and nothing else, we literally jumped out of our chairs," which is a bit of a tragedy if you are a brain surgeon. Okay, then they went to another one. They looked at another patient with a neuron, and this time they didn't test Jennifer Aniston. They tested Halle Berry. Pictures of Halle Berry. You can see these are heterosexual males doing these neurosurgeries.
Yes.
And that neuron, they found a neuron separate from the Jennifer Aniston neuron that responded only to photographs of Halle Berry, and then eventually drawing an image of her, and then finally just her name. What's more interesting, even when Berry was costumed as Catwoman, I think she, right after she won her Academy Award, didn't she star in the movie Catwoman?
Yes, and won the award for worst movie of the year, the Raspberry, yes.
Yeah, it was kind of the schizophrenic career thing.
Yeah.
If the patient knew it was Berry, the neuron still fired, and the patient had never seen Catwoman before, it didn't. So the neuron appeared to be responding to an abstract concept of Halle Berry rather than to any particular visual feature, and ergo, all of a sudden, you've got dramatic illustrations of the grandmother hypothesis.
Now, it's interesting because you started the interview by saying we know so little. That is fascinating,
yeah.
The Jennifer Aniston neuron, but it just really seems like the tip of the iceberg about what that could possibly mean. Specific neurons
really
for specific facts, yeah.
Yeah, what does that mean for education? What does that mean for business? Well, what it means is squat.
Yeah.
We have no idea what that means. But we're only in the beginning stages. And what the book I actually wrote, Mike, because I've been primarily a private consultant most of my life. I've got dual faculty appointments, and I've founded a couple of brain research institutes. But most of my life has been spent as a troubleshooter. And I would get on an airplane, and I would read about these things like brain science is going to reveal to us our voting preferences.
Yeah.
Brain science is going to give us there's your Mozart effect we were talking about previously, and sometimes
which is playing classical music to a baby, and it supposedly helps them. And Governor Zell Miller of Georgia said, "Let's do it by law," but there's been no evidence to show playing Mozart to a baby makes them smarter.
That's right. And in some cases, when you are playing certain types of digital media for a post-term baby, that you actually, in one particular case, a DVD for vocabulary acquisition, that because the baby wants to explore, it doesn't want to have its information fed to it, crammed down its throat, that they actually learn less in those passive modes than if you just allow the baby to explore.
Let me interrupt you. Have you seen those My Baby Can Read infomercials? You think they might be dangerous?
Well, this almost triggered a lawsuit, and I can now mention this on the air because it happened at the University of Washington, whereby Baby Einstein was actually tested, a DVD that purported to change and alter cognitive development in your developing child. And when it was actually tested, it was found that babies who were trying to learn a language with the DVD, as opposed to just a human speaking to them, the baby with the DVD learned 6 to 8 words fewer per unit time than the baby that was just talked to by a regular human being.
Yeah, I have a 2-year-old, and we totally stayed away from Baby Einstein. But now he watches the Diego, and they have this thing where Diego talks to the kid and says, can you say piñata? And there's a pause, and I really worry about that.
Well, there is some fascinating research upon which I think the marketing takes a left turn, but it's based on something interesting. Many years ago, a woman named Patricia Cool found something fascinating about phoneme acquisition in babies. They found that when a baby was 6 months of age, a baby could distinguish between every phoneme, that's the sound of a language, every phoneme of every language that has ever been invented. Whether you're talking about Finnish or those amazing click languages in West Africa or German or Japanese, quite literally, a native Japanese speaker could distinguish between rake and lake at 6 months of age. She calls them citizens of the world. At 12 months of age, though, and this is the most important finding that was actually published in the journal Science, the most important finding was that at 12 months of age, all of that nice egalitarianism had gone away. And now the baby only can discriminate between the phonemes to which he or she has been exposed during that 6-month critical period of development. So now these are all preverbal infants, Mike, but between 6 and 12 months of age, the baby's brain deploys what is essentially a weighted average phoneme sensor. and asks the question, what am I hearing? And based upon that exposure will rewire its brain such that by the age of 12 months, if they've not heard the sound, they cannot hear the sound at 12 months and never will again the rest of their natural lives. Quite literally, a native Japanese speaker at 6 months of age can distinguish between rake and lake, but if they've not heard that strong Germanic sound in 6 months, at 12 months of age, cannot distinguish between rake and lake and never will again for the rest of their natural lives.
Oh, my gosh. We only have a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you a question that Juliana from Virginia asked on, I think it was our Facebook page. Does it matter what activities you're doing when you're exercising? I often listen to audiobooks or podcasts when I'm running. Am I missing some crucial brain downtime just to exercise without thoughts going through my head?
Well, that's a really good question. The answer is an interesting one because it's got some empirical support. The sweet spot is you have to do aerobic exercise now, not strengthening to get these data. Strengthening doesn't factor. There's great reasons to do strengthening, but it has nothing to do with brain power. The sweet spot appears to be immediately after you have exercised, at the time when you normally go and take a shower. This was done at the University of Tübingen with a bunch of executives who had to learn Mandarin, whereby they exercised them, and instead of having them go take a shower, instead they had those executives sit down for a Mandarin class and were able to show that at that cool down period, their rate of Mandarin acquisition, vocabulary acquisition, increased 20% over the controls. 20%, Mike, simply by having them at a certain sweet spot have their learning captured. So I would say to the caller from Virginia that she exercise, and then after she's exercised, instead of going take a shower, break out the calculus book and get started.
All right. Dr. John Medina, who teaches at the University of Washington, is the author of Brain Rules, 12 Principles for Surviving and Thriving at Work, Home, and School. Thank you.
Oh, what a pleasure.
And before we go, I want to, an etymological red flag has been raised. Does pediatrician come from the fact that Socrates walked around? More likely, it has been raised to us. It just comes from the Greek word for child. That's the ped part. Anyway, there you go. We like to correct all possible examples of misinformation. This has been Mike Pesca in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for joining me today.